You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 23rd of October 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
We're going to choose hope over fear. We're going to choose to move forward because we have enormous opportunities to make things better.
Perhaps a glimpse of things to come from Joe Biden. We'll get an analysis of the final presidential debate before Trump and Biden face each other at the polls on November the 3rd. Then in, out, and shake it all about. Where are we with the Brexit hokey-cokey? As the EU chief negotiators now in London and the talks appear to be back on. To Thailand next, where the emergency decree banning mass gatherings has been repealed. Is this really a victory for protesters? We'll go live to Bangkok. Plus...
The Florida settlement of Lakeland has put a proportion of its swan population up for sale, fearing imminent overrun by the long-necked beak owners.
Andrew Muller highlights what we know now that we didn't 7 days ago, particularly in the important area of large aquatic birds. We'll get the latest business news from Louise Cooper, Charles Hecker will guide us through the papers, and then Guy Delaunay will be on hand to bring us some lighter stories from the Balkans. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The UK has signed its first post-Brexit trade deal with Japan in a new agreement that will take effect on January the 1st. Singapore and Germany have agreed to open a travel corridor for business travel between the two countries. And, citing comments from Pope Francis, Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, has asked the country's National Assembly to consider legalising same-sex marriage. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, last night, the final presidential debate took place between the incumbent Donald Trump and his challenger Joe Biden in Nashville, Tennessee. Our US election correspondent Thomas Lewis was watching carefully.
Well, firstly, it was a totally different proposition to the first presidential debate that took place in Cleveland, Ohio, back at the beginning of the month. Both candidates, I think, performed much better than they did on that occasion. Donald Trump played by the rules a lot more this time around, but he'd obviously come prepared to say the things that his team and his campaign felt that he should say. So I think the main things among that strategy was to try and pitch Trump as this kind of outsider. At one point, he looked at Joe Biden and said, "You're the reason that I ran for president in the first place," saying that Joe Biden's 47 years at the top level of US politics was the problem with US politics and US life at the moment. I think that was slightly undone by the fact that he has been president for 4 years now, so slightly intriguing that he felt that this kind of slightly more free-flowing persona would chime with voters who maybe weren't considering voting for him before. Joe Biden had a very good performance, I think it's fair to say. He really got a lot of time in to put a lot of detail into things, and he also sustained his attacks on President Trump. Even when there were moments of interruption, he managed to sort of rebound and recalibrate his arguments pretty successfully, I think. There is a moment at the end of the debate that Donald Trump's campaign has said it will make much of, and that is that Joe Biden said in perhaps more explicit terms than he'd intended to, that he would gradually aim to phase out the oil industry in the United States. I think a lot of those who support a sort of climate-led agenda in US government would see that as inevitable. But perhaps the way Biden said it was a little more blunt than maybe he'd intended. We'll see what impact that has, if that is now a line of strategy by the Trump campaign going forward to Election Day. What they they tried to lean very heavily on tonight was on Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son. It felt as though those moments weren't particularly successful, given that it just made it seem like the president wasn't necessarily interested in governing the country, but more on personality politics and getting one over on his rival. So it will be interesting to see what the sort of immediate polling after the debate is, because I think there's a sense that it won't have shifted the needle too much at all, but that it was a much better debate by both candidates the first time around. We'll just have to see whether certain points, either on the separation of children at the border, the handling of the coronavirus pandemic, or indeed this idea of the oil industry, whether any of those become this kind of major talking point in the days to come following today's debate. And if that is the case, perhaps then we will see some movement in the opinion polls. But the sentiment, I think, is that there won't be some huge bombshell moment that will really change the course of things, particularly given that more than 40 million Americans have already voted and have already made their choice.
That was Thomas Lewis talking immediately after the debate last night. And listening to that with me is Brian Klass, who's Assistant Professor in Global Politics at UCL and co-author of How to Rig an Election. Brian, what did polling after the debate say?
Well, it's very preliminary, and we haven't gotten reliable polling yet, because they do these sort of flash polls, which show varying results. But I think the key is that this was not a game changer. And that's what President Trump needed this to be. He needed this to be something that reset the race completely, and this wasn't that. You know, it's like doctors pledge to first do no harm. A candidate with a big lead in the polls needs to stick to that mantra, and Biden did no harm last night. And I think that is the big takeaway. And it's the last moment in which Trump had an opportunity to actually change the course of the race, because now until November 3rd, there's just going to be rallies. There's not going to be any sort of major events that Biden and Trump will square off in. And that means that the polls, as we see them now, are probably going to be what it looks like going into Election Day.
With Biden having a substantial lead.
Yes, exactly. And I think that that's also, you know, the problem that Trump has, as was mentioned in the previous piece, is that 49 million Americans have voted. In some swing states, more than half of voters have already cast their ballots. So even if Trump were to narrow the gap now, he has a much smaller pool of voters that he's actually competing for, right? Because a lot of people have already cast their ballots. It doesn't matter what's said now because it's already been done. And that's why, you know, this is a much harder race for him to come back from, because in not only losing the fact that there are so many voters who've already cast ballots, but also it's such a polarized electorate that almost nobody has not made up their mind. In other words, everybody has an opinion about Donald Trump, and the idea that a 90-minute debate is going to change their view over the last 3.5 years is, I think, you know, far-fetched. So the state of the race is extremely stable, and that's good news for Joe Biden.
Mm. How do you think having that mute button affected it? I mean, Trump was unable to talk over Biden very much, or at least not as much as he had done before.
Yeah, I think this made the debate much more substantive. You had a situation in the first debate in which it was defined by Trump constantly interrupting Biden and, you know, behaving sort of like a bully. This debate was more sober. I don't think it was a good debate. I think that the bar was lowered to the floor by Trump, and so this one seemed good in comparison. But the microphone muting, you know, it's almost this symbol of how far American politics has fallen, that the only possible way of dealing with the candidates was to ensure that they had a technological means of intervening to shut them up. And I think that is, you know, if anything, a takeaway from the 2020 debates is that our politics is so broken that and so disrespectful that you actually needed a mute button on it.
The New York Times comes up with at least 25 facts that Trump mentioned that were inaccurate. What can you tell us about what are, I mean, we're calling them inaccurate facts. Lies is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I mean, there was a series of the constant ones that Trump brings up, you know, the stuff about Hunter Biden that is not rooted in reality, the discussion of climate change, wind turbines, Trump saying that he is the least racist person in the world, stuff like this, which is just, it's beyond the pale. It's obviously untrue. But this speaks to a broader strategy from the debate and Trump's campaign in general, is that he has typically campaigned for his base, for people who already believe what he says. And, you know, this is something that's not a very good strategy because he needs to win beyond the base. And so these things that he says that are untrue, they work for people who already believe him. They don't work for people who are not already converts to the campaign. And that's a real problem for Trump because he can't win with the base alone. It's simply impossible for him. It's not a big enough group of people. And so, you know, he's in a situation where, again, you know, the strategy that he's adopted for the last 6 months has not been a winning one. And that's why it's not likely that he's going to win on November 3rd.
Mm. I thought Christian Welker, the moderator, was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, much better than Chris Wallace, who was the moderator for the first debate. There's no question about that. Much more assertive, much more willing to sort of play the referee. And I think that, you know, again, the debates in history are not about the moderator. The debates in history are not about the mute button. And so I think that the focus on these things is really an indictment of President Trump, that he's changed the format so much that we have to worry about who plays referee when someone lies, who plays referee when someone interrupts or bullies the opponent. And I think that's what's going to be remembered from these debates. I don't think there's any lines from last night's debates that will end up in history books. I do think that the sort of overall disaster that was the debate last time will end up in the history books. And I think that will be more of a coarseness of our discourse and also a coarseness of our politics, not as much as the actual lines or attacks or substance of the debate.
Mm. Brian, your book is called How to Rig an Election, and Donald Trump is alleging that this election is already rigged. New York Times and others now reporting that Russia and Iran have also tried to meddle in the democratic process. And we know there's a great deal of fake news out there. Is this going to be a fair election?
Well, there's two categories of manipulation. One is the category that is false, which Trump is alleging, and that's voter fraud and mail-in ballot fraud. And that's going to be very rare, as it always is in U.S. politics. There's another aspect of election manipulation that is real, and that is voter suppression. And that is happening, right? There are long lines to vote, much more disproportionately long lines in heavily African-American neighborhoods by design. Things like this, which are, you know, very problematic about U.S. elections. But this election is not substantially different from other elections in terms of its integrity. So, you know, I think Trump, if he loses, will probably say that it was rigged based on no evidence. And that will be a very big problem for the U.S. as a whole if the election is close. If the election is not close, if it's a landslide, nobody will believe President Trump and it won't really matter that much. So I'm looking for what the margin is on November 3rd, and I'll be much, much more worried if it comes down to one or two states and the margin is razor thin.
Brian, thank you very much indeed. That was Brian Klass there.
We're changing the way we do subscriptions at Monocle, and there's never been a better time to sign up. We've just launched our first ever digital subscription. The new look Monocle Digital Editions offers improved access to the magazine on the go, at the touch of a button, and is rather dashing too. It also includes our extensive archive of global reporting and a growing roster of travel guides and tips. Whether you opt for print and digital or digital only, your subscription will include unlimited access to the Monocle Digital Editions. That goes for existing subscribers too. Head to monocle.com/subscribe to sign up.
Last Friday, Downing Street announced that talks with the European Union over an exit deal for Britain were over unless the bloc fundamentally altered its position. Michel Barnier was told that there was no point in a planned trip to Whitehall for talks with negotiators. Yet, after a standoff of a week, Barnier is in London. So, what changed? Naomi O'Leary, Europe correspondent for the Irish Times, joins me. Naomi, who blinked first? Can you tell us what happened between Johnson's remarks last week and the arrival of Barnier yesterday?
Well, no doubt the two sides will have different interpretations of this, but certainly in Brussels, it's seen that, you know, the EU called Britain's bluff, really, and said, well, you know, if you're going to pull out of talks, then go for it. And what's happened is that the UK side has said, oh, OK, fine, we'll continue talks. So they never actually stopped talking entirely throughout the whole period. So the two chief negotiators, David Frost and Michel Barnier, were on the phone to each other, even though they pulled off the official sort of sitting down talks with all of the negotiating teams. But what happened was Michel Barnier gave an address to the European Parliament in which he talked about the progress of the Brexit negotiations, and he gave an update. And he also he used a bit of language which the UK side was reassured by. So he talked about respect for British sovereignty. He used the word sovereignty several times. The speech was given in French. And after that, the UK side issued a statement and said that they, you know, they'd kind of taken heart by this, and they saw that there was, you know, perhaps a change in attitude, and the talks could continue. So the two sides made a joint statement saying that they were going to enter intense negotiations, and they were going to talk every day, including through the weekends, in an attempt to find a deal, because time now is very short.
No, absolutely. I mean, do you think there is a possibility of there being an agreement by the end of this weekend?
The end of this weekend, I think, is ambitious. Though perhaps we should probably expect it to be decided one way or another within the next maybe fortnight, possibly 3 weeks, because this is sort of the last moment, really. So we'll have to see. At the end of the day, the two sides still do have quite separate issues. There probably is room for a deal somewhere on fisheries if both sides move a bit. But, you know, there are principles which the two sides will find difficult to reconcile. And I think that will be difficult to sell domestically at home in Britain as well.
And who do you think is going to have to compromise most, and will they be willing to do so?
Well, they've both said that, you know, both sides have to compromise. But, you know, the EU has called on the UK to move. Well, they've both called on each other to move substantially, I suppose. But, you know, they do have limits in terms of what they can do. The EU27 member states are constrained by what the national governments will support. And there's a lot of governments which are very committed to protecting fishing if they can, for example. So France has been making a bit of a stand on that, not wanting to do too much of a compromise on fisheries and lose access to British waters. But they don't hold all the cards on that one. They're in a weaker position. And then on the level playing field, which is basically a way of saying ensuring that British companies can't undercut EU companies, the EU is in a stronger position on that one, but some of the compromises may be difficult for Britain.
Mm. Now, as we were reporting in our headlines, Britain has just made a big deal with Japan. Is that going to impact on this at all?
I think that the EU will probably see that as encouraging and say that, you know, this is sort of shows the strength of our market. And, at the moment, it's supposed to be the UK who's going around striking trade deals with everybody. But, you know, like many aspects of Brexit, that may increasingly prove to be more difficult than it sounds. Because, you know, all of the sort of big trading blocks around the world or trading powers will have their own demands, just like the EU does. So it is difficult when you're on a project which is based around the idea of claiming back sovereignty and setting your own rules, to then go into negotiations in which the other side are going to ask you for changes to those things.
Mm. Now, of course, no deal is still a prospect, and the Prime Minister held a call with business leaders recently. Small businesses particularly are very upset. They feel that there's very, very little support, particularly if there's no deal. But even if there is a deal, they are going to need a substantive packages to get them through this, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The kind of deal that the two sides are looking at now, because the UK has asked for so much of a change to the relationship, it requires a lot of red tape for businesses, whether there's a deal or not. So, you know, businesses exporting in and out of the UK will have to do customs declarations. You know, there are expected to be very, very long queues of trucks at Dover, and that's in a deal scenario because of all of the new sort of procedures that they're going to have to go through. And essentially what it means is less choice for consumers, because when you add costs to the trade in goods like that, then it becomes less feasible to send smaller amounts of goods between countries and more niche things. So it will mean that ultimately there'll be less choice on the supermarket shelves, and probably prices will go up. And also, you know, this isn't just about trading goods, it's about every aspect of the economic and trade relationship. And there's all sorts of changes throughout that, you know, everything from things like the ability, obviously, of UK citizens to move around Europe, to passenger rights, you know, your ability to claim back money if your flight has been cancelled. You know, there's really, it's very profound, the shift that's happening. And I think it's interesting that just recently, I use a number of banking and insurance services that would have been headquartered in the UK. And the last couple of weeks, I've gotten two emails from two services that I personally use saying that they are moving my account into out of the UK and into EU jurisdictions, so into Lithuania and Dublin. And that's all part of this preparation for the end of the year.
Naomi, thank you very much indeed. That's Naomi O'Leary. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll check in with the protests in Bangkok. We'll get the latest business news with Louise Cooper and...
The Florida settlement of Lakeland has put a proportion of its swan population up for sale, fearing imminent overrun by the long-necked beak owners.
Andrew Muller gives us breaking swan news. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
For 3 months now, protests have been taking place all over Thailand. Youngsters have been challenging the monarchy and the establishment. Last week, the authorities introduced an emergency decree banning gatherings of more than four people. However, this exacerbated the situation, and yesterday, the government rescinded the measure. Well, Gwen Robinson, Monocle's Bangkok correspondent, is on the line. Gwen, good morning to you. What led to this backtracking by the government?
Well, it seems to be part of the latest development, which is a lot of confusion and forward and backward. And this suspension of the emergency decree, I think, is the strongest sign yet that the government is increasingly on the back foot and clearly has rolled this out in an effort to appease protesters, calm things down. We've also seen a lot of the people arrested being released. This follows the court overturning an earlier government order to censor and even ban some key media organisations. And that was overturned the day before yesterday. And last night we saw protesters released even hours after being arrested. So I think the suspension of the emergency decree was really a response to growing pressure and some pretty severe statements from even international human rights groups and UN agencies. So you know, I think that's the pattern right now, is a lot of confusion about where we're actually at.
The Prime Minister was given a deadline to resign by the people. Do you think that there's any chance he would consider that?
I think your guess is as good as mine at this point, because everything sort of changes every day. I mean, you get some very sort of strong, almost belligerent statements from the Prime Minister, and then he came out all conciliatory. But certain pro-government protesters and some agencies, certain security forces have shown continuing, you know, hostility, if not, you know, taken some more forceful actions. So, you know, there's a mixture, and I think police themselves also seem confused. But there was an extraordinary spectacle 2 days ago where, you know, riot police lined up with shields and crowds of student protesters. And it really looked like there'd be a clash, and suddenly the police melted away, gave way, let the students through on a march. So I think, you know, all bets are off about, you know, what the government is really thinking. I think, you know, what the most obvious thing is that there is no proper strategy right now from the government. I think they're making policy on the hoof. There are directives coming down from above. But behind it all, of course, is, you know, the all-powerful force of the king lurking in the background, or at least way above. And one thing is for sure, I think there's probably been some communication to security forces not to use force or be excessive against the protesters.
Mm. And I mean, aside from complaints about the monarchy, what else is it that the demonstrators want?
Well, that's also a good question. It seems to be moving with the times. But, you know, the three core demands haven't really changed that much from the last in recent weeks, and they are to amend the constitution, which they feel is skewed, and it was drawn up by a military-backed, well, in fact, under the previous junta regime. And then they want reform of the monarchy, and they've made it very clear. And that's the kind of theme, I think, that's come to dominate in recent weeks. I think, though, that the protesters are quite divided about where that monarchy issue stands in their priorities. At the moment, if you look at some of the protests, you'd think that that is the only issue, or at least the overwhelming number one issue. But the third thing, that the Prime Minister should resign, has also been boiling along, as you know. And right now we're on the second day of a three-day ultimatum for Prime Minister Prayut to resign. That deadline is tomorrow. And in answer to your question, I don't think there's any way he can possibly just step down because there are students protesting on the streets. I mean, that's just my reading of the kind of ruler or leader Prayut has been, very dogmatic, an army general who seized power in a coup in 2014 and is now sort of through a semblance of sort of semi-sham democracy. He won elections that were kind of, you know, skewed under the system drawn up by the government. He believes that he has a duty and a right to stay in his place. So I think it's highly unlikely that you'd see him saying, OK, guys, if you don't like me, I'm going.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a sort of lack of any kind of cohesive plan from the authorities. What about the demonstrators? Is there a strategy, and are there set leaders?
That's an even better question. These student-led protesters have shown amazing resourcefulness, creativity, resilience, determination, and a lot of it is about tactics. I can't, you know, one thing that seems to be missing is this overarching central strategy. I think that's being made up, and also I think, you know, it's not that clear that this is not a monolithic movement. There are these huge chat groups working over the Line app and also Telegram increasingly, numbering some of them. One group numbers 35,000, and every day there are open chats and votes about what to do, where to go. New things come up. There's a whole new jargon and hand symbols and lots of tactics. As far as the overall strategy, I think what is the only thing that's clear is that they are determined to keep this up, and nothing will appease them apart from the resignation of the Prime Minister and, as mentioned, you know, concrete steps to reform the constitution. And on the King, I just don't know what their end game is. If, you know, obviously the King is not going to resign or go away. So I think their intention is just to keep up the pressure. Mm. But, you know, the strategy, as I said, I think is evolving. That said, the tactics are very impressive.
And Gwen, for you, going about your daily life in Bangkok, what's the mood there? I mean, are people frightened? Are they exhilarated?
Well, that's yet another good question. You know, there's such a disconnect. I mean, I'm in a very, you know, hip central shopping mall that has fantastic cafes and things like that. You walk through that and you wouldn't even know that this is a society in complete turmoil. You go down to some of the parks and along the street, you wouldn't know. You go to a protest area, it looks like the whole country is blowing up. So there is that real disconnect. I think today is a public holiday and there's a real sense the students have paused. There's some protests being staged around the city, but they're very small ones. I think everyone is sort of tired, wants a breather. And so, you know, there's no sense of tension today, but, you know, they'll be back, and particularly after the deadline passes. And it is this very, very discombobulated feeling in Bangkok that, you know, you can get any kind of scene you choose. And let's not forget, it's spread around the country. So we had 20 areas of Thailand last week on a single day where had protests going on downtown, and I think that's likely to spread as well. So, you know, it's really very much where the action is. And obviously, I think for the international, you know, people watching it on screens, media is like targeting areas where things are happening. So I think the impression on TV screens or on social media is that the whole place is blowing up. In fact, you know, most of it is not. Most of it, business is carrying on. Where it goes from here, though, could be anywhere. It could descend into complete anarchy. Who knows if more protesters join these crowds. But so far, I think the maximum has been maybe 60,000 or so, maybe a bit more than that. No more than that. But if we get a scenario like we've seen in Eastern Europe, you know, it really could look anarchic.
Gwen, thank you very much indeed. That's Gwen Robinson. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The UK has signed its first post-Brexit trade deal with Japan in a new arrangement that will take effect on January the 1st. The UK's International Trade Secretary, Liz Truss, signed off on the deal today in Tokyo. It closely resembles the existing EU-Japan trade deal, but also adds a chapter on digital trade and doesn't include agricultural quotas. Singapore and Germany have agreed to open a travel corridor for business travel between the two countries. Details on the application process and health protocols have yet to be released. The new agreement could serve as a model for further deals between Singapore and other European countries. Yesterday, Japan announced it would also start allowing business travellers from a few countries to enter. And citing comments from Pope Francis, Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, has asked the country's National Assembly to discuss same-sex marriage during its next session in January. The Pope's comments in a new documentary mark the clearest language he's used to date on gay rights. Same-sex marriage is currently not legal in largely Catholic Venezuela, although Argentina, Brazil and Colombia have already legalised same-sex marriage. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, it's Friday, and Andrew Muller is here to point out all the things we've learned during the course of this week.
We learned this week that, quite contrary to appearances, not all of American politics has descended into irrecoverably entrenched partisan name-calling, hair-pulling and bun-throwing. In Utah, that's the state song popping cheerfully away in the background, there was a heartening outbreak of seemliness as the rival candidates for governor, Democrat Chris Peterson and Republican Spencer Cox, appeared in an ad together which was kind of a campaign spot for each other.
I'm Chris Peterson.
And I'm Spencer Cox.
We are currently in the final days of campaigning against each other to be your next governor.
And while I think you should vote for me...
Yeah, but really you should vote for me.
There are some things we both agree on.
We can debate issues without degrading each other's character.
We can disagree without hating each other.
And win or lose in Utah, we work together.
So let's show the country that there's a better way.
My name's Chris Peterson.
And I'm Spencer Cox.
And
we approve this message.
We further learned, upon taking a long, hard look at polling for Utah's gubernatorial race, that the Democrat Peterson had little to lose in agreeing to this demonstration of goodwill, so fair play especially to presumptive Governor-elect Cox, and maybe you should bear this in mind next time one of his co-religionists ruins your bath by knocking on your door and attempting to interest you in the prophecies encoded in ancient Egyptian text found on gold plates in 19th century New York State and translated via a talking rock in a hat. The Mormons, very arguably the world's least annoying evangelists. We will be returning to the intersection of religious prophecy and American politics later in this monologue, so this bit also works as a clever and subtle exercise in foreshadowing.
I'm looking forward to seeing where this is going.
These are always very clever.
He certainly doesn't just crank these out.
There is nothing like a day, nothing in the world.
In Australia, we learned what the recent doomed attempt by former Prime Minister and massive onion-eating weirdo Tony Abbott to bring back imperial honours was actually worth. $135,000 Australian dollars, the value ascribed to a set of medals which were yet to be draped around the collar of some lucky dame or knight by the time the scheme was mercifully binned by Abbott's successor. We also learned, after looking into what this most ex of Australian ex-Prime Ministers is up to these days, that Tony Abbott is also at the centre of another controversy for having twice in recent months been given permission to leave Australia when many of his fellow citizens cannot. It seems pretty clear what Australia's government is attempting here, and it's hard to see why anyone is complaining. If everyone doesn't shut up, even Tony Abbott will figure this out. We learned that Florida, already beloved by newscasters the world over as the "and finally" state, is not merely diligently upholding its commitment to furnishing bizarre and or idiotic news stories, but has branched out further into providing open goals for avian puns.
Good, here we go again.
The Florida settlement of Lakeland has put a proportion of its swan population up for sale, fearing imminent overrun by the long-necked beak owners. Lakeland's swan plague originated in 1953 as a well-meaning gift from Queen Elizabeth II, who was moved by a letter from a local seeking sympathy for the fact that such swans as Lakeland possessed had been eaten by alligators. Whether out of genuine goodwill or subtle revenge for what America had done to her great-great-great-great, we think that's right, grandfather 177 years previously, QE2 sent a pair of royal swans, whose descendants now number an apparently unmanageable 86. You might say they've been...
Please not again.
...causing a flap.
Ugh, dear God, no.
Anyway, attentive listeners will recall being promised that the earlier item about an outbreak of bipartisan good fellowship in Utah was being wheeled out as the setup to a looming payoff. So we also learned this week that, grim though the prospect of US President Benito Cartman winning re-election on November 3rd is, it might be even worse than we dare imagine. And we learned this from one of the president's most indefatigable supporters, the bewilderingly influential televangelist and absolutely raging dingbat, Pat Robertson. In what Robertson appeared to believe was some sort of endorsement of Trump, he vouchsafed to his agog audience of elderly lunatics that God had informed him that the president's re-election would presage the actual apocalypse.
And what I think, very frankly, is that the only thing that will fulfill what the word of Jesus, that I'm going to give you in a minute, is some kind of an asteroid strike on the globe.
In fairness, this doesn't sound like the kind of thing God would just make up. So we learned that should Donald Trump be returned, we can anticipate the obliteration of humankind by a divinely ordained meteorite. This scenario is what is known in military circles by the three-letter acronym SSP, for self-solving problem. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you, Andrew. This is The Globalist. Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me on the line is Charles Hecker, who's senior partner at Control Risk. Good morning to you, Charles.
Good morning, Georgina.
Are you a bit knackered, as am I, from having got up at 2 o'clock in the morning to watch the debate?
You know, I decided to opt for a good night's sleep, I'm afraid to say. I really don't know whether this was the watch that I wanted to have last night.
Well, it's really interesting. As we were discussing at the top of the programme, the mute button is making headlines. And of course, it should all be about the content. But in fact, it was the means rather than what was said that seems to be in the papers. So tell us something about that.
That's right. You mentioned the mute button a little bit earlier in the broadcast in your conversation with Brian Kloss. And the Washington Post has done us a great favor by essentially writing a column about the mute button. And the headline here is, "The mute button was a godsend. It also amplified the candidates' differences." So bada bing right there in the headline, mute button amplifying. Get it? So the column is a discussion of the issues, but it's an emphasis on the behaviors that were triggered by the mute button itself. And actually, it starts out, frankly, with a nod to the fact that everyone in the audience was wearing masks, including the Trump family, because apparently event organizers threatened to physically remove anybody who didn't wear a mask. And so everyone was masked up. The columnist who wrote this piece is Robin Given, who used to be the Washington Post's fashion correspondent.
And who, incidentally, she features very heavily in our latest edition of the magazine, just chucking that in there.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, yeah. Well, that's great. So she used to be the fashion critic for the paper, but now she's a senior columnist. And she mentioned that the candidate's spouses wore masks that match their dresses. But anyway, on to the mute button. And so here's what Robin Given tells us about the debate. And there was also, by the way, a video accompanying this piece, which is hilarious. And I recommend going to the website and watching. And so what we see is that instead of, and this is a quote from the piece, instead of a constant stream of interruptions, there was a miming display of emotion, head nodding, smirking, eye rolling, and wide-eyed grimaces. There were shrugs, there was hand flailing, and there was finger jabbing. And so I guess what happens is when you can't move your lips because the mute button is on, you move everything else in your body. And so we had this incredibly kinetic display of energy and of criticism and of irony. And when it comes to the sort of wide-eyed grimaces, it made me think of President Trump, who, when you think about it, has actually an incredibly elastic face and is able to sort of morph into all of these different shapes. And I think he is the champion of the wide-eyed grimace. But it's a great piece about what happens when essentially, you know, you've got you're muzzled by the mute button and you've got to do something to non-verbally express agreement or disagreement or discord. And I recommend this piece.
Political pantomime.
Exactly right.
Let's go to the New York Times now. Now, yesterday we ran this story about the Pope's remarks on same-sex unions. He said that actually it's not, you know, a sin any longer and all the rest of it. But now it turns out that this was not breaking news. He actually said this about a year ago, but it's been hidden.
That's right. So here's a great piece of reporting and a great piece of sleuthing and a story of Vatican intrigue. And you're absolutely right that the Pope's remarks just the other day supporting same-sex unions and supporting a legal framework for men to marry each other, for women to marry each other, went off like a bombshell around the world. But it turns out, according to the New York Times, and here's the headline, it says, Pope's remarks on same-sex unions were cut from a 2019 Vatican interview. So apparently, according to the New York Times, the Pope was giving a fairly wide-ranging interview to a Mexican broadcasting company called Televisa. But the Vatican retained the ultimate rights over that broadcast. And what it did before providing the video to Televisa is it edited out the remarks about supporting same-sex civil unions and a legal framework and essentially supporting gay marriage almost. And then it took the unedited version of this interview and it put it deep into the Vatican archives. So along comes this year's documentary on the Pope, and the researchers for that documentary went deep into those very Vatican archives and they found the unedited footage of the interview with the Mexican broadcaster from last year. And what they did was they excerpted those comments from last year's remarks. They dropped them into this year's documentary, which was then put on display at the Rome Film Festival and then made this amazing sort of explosion of agreement and discord and controversy all around the world just the other day. So, you know, a hugely progressive remark from the Pope on same-sex marriage and on civil unions, but a healthy dose of Vatican intrigue underpinning the entire episode.
Charles, I want to end off by looking at Halloween. Now, a friend of mine recently posted on social media that they are actually going to dress up for Halloween as a normal person without a mask, because that really seems to freak people out.
Is it the scariest costume of all, actually, right, is going out in the streets without a mask.
How do they do it in Japan?
Well, so first of all, is it all that surprising to learn that Halloween is massive in Japan? But there will be a few modifications to the celebrations in Japan. And one of the big ones is that Shibuya Crossing, which of course is that famous pedestrian crossing that just floods with people when the cross lights, when the lights turn green, Shibuya Crossing will be off limits. Because what is normally a Halloween hotspot might turn into a virus hotspot because of the thousands of people that throng to that crossing for Halloween celebrations. What one of Japan's big cities, Kawasaki, in Shinagawa Prefecture will be doing is it's putting its Halloween celebrations online, and it's having a costume contest. And the winner of that costume contest will actually take away a prize approaching almost $5,000. So it might be worth getting a bit dolled up to go on video. And the thinking here is that Halloween, of course, is a celebration designed to cast away evil spirits. In Japan, authorities are hoping that this will help cast away the coronavirus. Tokyo Disneyland has canceled its Halloween celebrations, saying that it's hoping to promote the safety of its visitors. But Yomiuri Land, a place that I think we've discussed before because it's allowing people to work from home in an amusement park, Yomiuri Land is allowing free weekend entry to anyone wearing a Halloween costume. So, you know, gather yourself up there. You can work from Yomiuri Land, and you can perhaps work in a costume from Yomiuri Land if you're so inclined on the weekends. I think that Japan will typically embrace this mostly American holiday with its great enthusiasm, but a few extra safety measures around the edges.
Absolutely. Charles Hecker, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time to talk business now with the financial analyst Louise Cooper. Oh, hi, Louise. Can you tell
Good
I'm being
morning,
slightly
Georgina.
Off with you?
Oh, no, I still haven't put you on it. On followed you on Twitter. Oh, I'm sorry, Georgina. It's been a busy week. I will.
Let's start talking about Goldman Sachs.
So this goes back to 2012, 2013, the Malaysian 1MDB scandal. It was a fund to raise money for Malaysia. And Goldman Sachs, big American investment bank, is up to his ears in it. It is now admitted in a US court it had paid more than $1 billion of bribes. To get involved and raise money for 1MDB. It is the first time the bank has ever admitted actually pleading guilty to criminal charges. It's cost the bank $3 billion in a settlement. It's already cost it a couple of billion dollars in settlement. So the total cost is over $5 billion now. What is also interesting about the story is they've clawed back executive compensation from a number of people, but from the current CEO and the past CEO. Of course, no one's ever ended up in prison because that's just not the way it works. But I think we need to remind ourselves what's underneath this story. What is under... No, so Malaysia is a very poor country. And this is, underneath this story, is a few very wealthy Goldman employees making themselves and their employer significantly richer. They're pretty rich already, at the expense of some of the poorest people in the world. Mm. You know, of taking money that was to fund education, a police service, a legal service and a health service for Malaysians and ripping it out of their country. So I think we always need to remind ourselves of the under, you know, they are, this is not a victimless crime.
Yeah. Let's have a very quick look at the detail of this new trade deal between UK and Japan.
So this is a bit of a political coup for Boris Johnson. Whilst the Brexit negotiations, the trade deal post-Brexit, are ongoing with the EU. To be honest, the deal they've signed with Japan, it's the first one with a major economy. You know, Japan, one of the largest economies in the world. But it's very much along the lines of the EU deal. I mean, the whole point that politicians sold Brexit is we'll get better deals than the EU. This is pretty similar because they haven't had time to negotiate much, you know, much difference to the EU deal. But of course, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. It is still, you know, an important part. The trade between Japan and the UK is not huge, to be honest. It's the UK's Japan's 18th largest trade partner. But, you know, it's a deal. In terms of the Brexit, post-Brexit trade deal, EU and the UK given themselves 3 weeks to finalise the trade deal. The last week's been quite lively after Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, basically said he was walking out a trade deal. It does look like some concessions have been made. We've got 3 weeks to go.
Finally, Louise, what are we spending on in lockdown?
So we know, Georgina, there's a bit of a cycling boom as everybody's taken to bikes and you couldn't buy a bike. But there's also a boom in motorcycles and scooters. So sales, new motorcycle registrations in the UK up 31% compared to September last year. 31%. And it's not just the UK. Germany, Austria, Netherlands, China, even the States, you're seeing this boom in motorcycles and scooters as people don't want to get on public transport. A feature of the UK inflation numbers released this week was that the price of secondhand cars is going up because people don't want to take public transport. But also we had results last night from the toy maker Mattel, and it seems during lockdown parents tried to bought their children toys in order to cope with the boredom of being locked at home. So Mattel had great results last night. Sales of Barbie dolls up extraordinarily, like 22% actually, which is somewhat surprising. Hasbro also did well. And of course, the getting your food delivered. So in a rare bit of good news for the job market, KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken, is adding 5,400 jobs in the UK and Ireland as we all stuff ourselves on takeaways. So there you go. There we go. So motorbikes, secondhand cars, Barbie dolls and KFC. Well, are you in any of those categories?
I'm not. What was the last thing in your Amazon basket?
I think it was probably a book, actually. I did buy my son an electric scooter because I thought that would be one way of him getting to school. And then the school banned scooters. So I was like, we have an electric scooter. Should anyone want one? Because sales of those are also booming.
Yeah. Buy your books from independent retailers. I must just get that in there. I bought bioethanol fuel for a fireplace and tennis balls for my dog. That was my last basket purchase. I think we should stop now, Louise.
I think so too.
You're going to get back on the Twitter now, are you?
Straight away.
Louise Cooper, thank you very much for joining us. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Now we're crossing to Belgrade to have a chat with Guy Delaunay. Guy, if you were considering a move within the Balkans, I understand that there's a new recommendation for somewhere most of us have never heard of, which is apparently the best place to live in Croatia.
This is true. And, you know, I must admit, Georgina, I had to look it up myself. So, you know, as the Balkans correspondent, and I'm actually now living in Ljubljana, so I did make the move from Belgrade, though I still have a flat there. I'd never heard of Čakovec. Had you heard of Čakovec?
Certainly not, no.
So I looked it up. I've been in the region of Čakovec. I've actually not been to Čakovec itself, but it's in the sort of northeastern corner of Croatia. Now, if you can get your sort of mental map sorted out here of where Croatia is in this part of Europe, it's right in the northeast corner. You've got Slovenia just bordering to the north and Hungary to the east. So it's quite a well-connected little place, but it is, as I said, a little place. It's not huge. It's got a population of 30,000 people, And it's come top of this annual survey, which is run by a couple of quite credible Croatian media companies and organised by the Ipsos company, the polling company. And they have deposed last year's winner, which was Zagreb, Croatia's capital, which obviously is many times the size. So Čakovec has clearly got something going for it.
What is it? What's it done to earn this?
So the interesting thing about this particular survey, this quality of life survey, it isn't just a matter of opinion. It isn't just going around to people in cities and saying, how do you like your life here? Is it good? They're actually measuring 26 different factors, which include things like average income and the allocations of public money for education, the standard of environmental protection, public transport. But a crucial one is demographics. And one of the things which the survey notes is that Čakovec is bucking this extremely worrying trend that they have in Croatia for emigration. I mean, Croatia's lost, some people say, getting on for a quarter of its population since it joined the European Union in 2013. I think that might be a slight exaggeration, but a lot of people certainly have taken advantage of freedom of movement to move out of the country. Čakovec, on the other hand, actually has, as the survey says, more people coming to work and live than emigrate. And that's not been done with glamorous projects, nothing sort of amazing in terms of, you know, a signature infrastructure project, a beautiful Frank Gehry museum or anything like that. It's been done by investing in areas which make it an attractive place for families. So in the kindergartens, in making the roads safer for people to move around and ensuring that it's just a pleasant place to live, in short.
So a great place to live, but is it a place that you'd want to visit?
Yeah, I looked this up. There isn't a lot in the way of attractions. There are some spas in the area, and that's where I've been to before. I actually ended up staying in a spa nearby during the height of the European refugee crisis, because it's on a border area. I ended up in a geothermal spa. So you can go to some of those in the area, which is quite handy. But one of its other claims to fame is it's known as the City of Traffic Circles, because it has replaced almost all of its traffic lights with roundabouts. And as a result, you're highly unlikely ever to get stuck in a traffic jam in Čakovec. So even if you don't like a Georgina, you'll find it pretty easy to get out.
It's sort of Milton Keynes of Croatia.
It does sound like it, doesn't it?
let's continue celebrating Croatia, because when we think of olive oil, we think of Italy, Spain, Greece, but apparently Croatia rules the world.
It does indeed. For the sixth consecutive year, the Flos Ole Guide, which I believe is a big thing in olive oil circles, has declared Croatia's Istria region the best region in the world for extra virgin olive oil, and it's assessed around 70 producers from Istria. This is the coastal region in the northwest of Croatia, and they have vastly improved the quality of their oil over the past 15 years. A lot of these producers are very much family producers. I know quite a few of them. But it's gone from being something which would have just been on local tables to something which is being exported all over the world and finds its way into some of the top kitchens. I mean, you've had various celebrity chefs have come to Istria and raved about the quality of the olive oil.
What's it like? Will you tell me?
Yes, I will tell you. It is. The thing is, it's one of these things, Georgina. Once you've tasted it, it's kind of difficult to take other olive oils seriously. It's not shy. It's developed from a variety called the Buja olive, and it's incredibly spicy. And it can be so spicy, if you get it wrong, it can kind of catch at the back of your throat, which doesn't sound particularly pleasant.
No.
But I can assure you, it is extremely pleasant. It's not amazingly cheap either, but it does make itself known in anything that you eat. So it's not one for sticking in your frying pan. It's very much one for dressing and drizzling.
Guy, we've only got a little tiny bit of time left, but tell us about Ljubljana's funky cultural district facing an existential threat.
So this is the Metelkova district of Ljubljana, which was a former military barracks, which was originally squatted by various counterculture institutions. Over the years, it's turned into quite an attraction in Ljubljana, various alternative artists and nightlife events taking place there. The city has seemed to embrace it, but now the government appears to be taking advantage of the crisis by ordering these alternative institutions to get out. And this could really, over the next few weeks and months, Georgina, turn into a big battle between Ljubljana's counterculture and the authorities.
Well, Guy, I'm now glad that you're based there, because you could be on the front line.
Thank you very much, Georgina.
That was Guy Delaunay, speaking just from Ljubljana. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache, Paige Reynolds and Carlotta Rabello. Our researcher was Charlie Filmer-Court and our studio manager, Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London and The Globalist returns on Monday. I can tell you that on Sunday, Meet the Writers, I featured the Australian chef, Bill Granger. He cooks me a meal in his lovely home kitchen. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.